Well, my name's Tony Gosling. I'm a freelance journalist in Bristol, former BBC radio reporter, and I do a programme called Friday Drive Time on the community radio here, which is a two-hour current affairs programme every week. And what I'd like to talk about today is basically how history has been mistaught to people. And there's a very famous philosopher who said that education is a system of imposed ignorance. So what we're taught in different parts of the world, as you, if you go and have a look at the curriculums that's taught in our schools, particularly primary and secondary, you know, sort of schools that everybody goes to, you'll find there's a lot of stuff missing from history, and also you know, there are threads throughout history which are just disjointed by the way the curriculum is presented. So we're living in a kind of crazy world in 2011, where, I mean, for example, just we're in January now, and we've just heard that the police infiltrated a protest to such an extent that they were actually instigating the protest, helping very much with the planning of it. So to what extent are £2 million or something spent on a police infiltrator, to what extent are they actually watching what's going on and using this to gather intelligence, and to what extent are they actually instigating the protests? This is one of the things we've really got to worry and wonder about, and we see the same within terrorist groups particularly, where it comes to light through things like Operation Gladio, that the authorities, the intelligence services and the police are not just observing when they infiltrate these groups, they are actually controlling the groups and determining their direction. And of course, in many of the cases that we've seen, I mean, this protest camp, the climate camp thing, is a very good example, because of the intelligence of the actual activists. They exposed this policeman infiltrator. Many of these, of course, the infiltrators are never exposed. They may even do a prison sentence as part of their job. And we've heard today that it's about £250,000 a year of public money is spent on one police infiltrator. So it gives us an idea of this kind of strange world we're living in, where the authorities actually seem to be turning against the population, even though they're supposed to be, we're supposed to be living in a democracy. That's one example. We had another really crazy example with Toyota cars, where some of the more modern Toyotas were actually accelerating up to 120 miles an hour without the occupants even putting their foot on the accelerator pedal. So this was put across to the public as, oh, we've got slightly sticky accelerators. But what's actually happening is you've got a computer-controlled car where your accelerator is just simply a switch which requests the computer to actually accelerate your car. We can't be living in this crazy world where technology is actually killing us in situations like that, and Toyota should make sure in future that all the major safety mechanisms in a car, like brakes, steering and accelerator, are actually controllable by the person driving the car, not by some computer. There's another example in January 2011, that is, we're just hearing that the private bank, which has been nationalised, the Royal Bank of Scotland, the boss stands to get something like a £7 million bonus this January. Now, we've had all the rhetoric from all the politicians, Conservative, Labour, Liberal, about how they're going to rein back bankers' bonuses. And yet, the one who we're paying his salary, the public, the Treasury, is in control of this bank, they are still allowing this guy to walk away with a £7 million bonus. Absolutely unbelievable, and it just shows that democracy is just becoming a total facade. So why is this? Anyway, I want to have a look through history at two threads of history, which are money and land, and we'll talk about more about that in a minute. Okay, money and land. What I'm saying is that these are two ways throughout history which have been slowly used to control people. It's sort of clenching down on the population. And firstly, land, because land everybody needs. I mean, it's even down there in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, everyone's right to shelter. Obviously, if you're going to have a shelter, you need land. And you also need a secure place to live. This is one of the most fundamental things in the world we're living today, is we know that if we have somewhere secure to live, we look after the place. If you go around many of the private rented sectors around Britain, you'll see that they are very dilapidated. That the private landlords don't actually care, because they're not using the building themselves, and so they often don't get maintained, they look a mess. If you've got security of tenure for you, your successors, your children, etc., if you can stay where you're living at the moment, you know forever, then you look after the place. And the reason that we're now on this very insecure system where you have to pay the rent every week, sometimes you don't, maybe every month, sometimes you don't know if you're going to be able to pay that rent, that creates a tremendous amount of instability in society. It's a very short-term way of a tiny number of landlord people actually making money off the backs of others. It's a very bad system, and it's a totally unequal system. We've got something like 60 million acres of land in Britain, and yet only something like 0.5% of the population owns nearly half of all the land. What we need to do is have some sort of program to redistribute that land so that people have got somewhere secure that they can first of all live, secondly, somewhere secure that they can do some work if they want to, and thirdly, somewhere where they can even possibly grow food, this kind of thing. So this is what we mainly need land for. We also need it to walk on, leisure at the weekends in the countryside. But we do need access to land for all sorts of reasons, most importantly, a home and a security of tenure. So if we go back right the way back, how did we get to this crazy position throughout history? The main, I think, if we go right the way back to Old Testament times, you'll see in the book of Leviticus that there's something called the Jubilee in Leviticus 25. And this recognised back in Old Testament times that there was no point, you should never be able to sell land permanently. And what it actually says is that the land is God's, and that the human beings on the planet are just God's tenants in a way. So the idea that it's your land to sell permanently is totally outlawed in the Bible, in the book of Leviticus. But this is something which has kind of slowly but surely over the years been forgotten. And the importance of it has been forgotten. But actually many of us now are acknowledging and remembering that it is actually very important. So that was remedied by the Jubilee. So you could sell a piece of land to a neighbour for a while, but after every 50 years it would be returned to its original owner. So there's no way you could permanently sell land. And this is something really, really important that we have to understand. That if we are actually part of a country, any country in the world, then actually we need to have an investment and security of tenure in the land of that country. Otherwise, that being part of that country doesn't really mean anything. And this has been slowly taken away from us over the years. And of course, one of the things that that's meant is that we are now much more dependent on money than we ever used to be. Now, money first really caught on in Britain after the Roman invasion, around about 50 AD. But even before that, in 30, around about 30 AD, Jesus threw the money changers out of the temple. Now, this was the only time that Jesus got really angry during his ministry. The goldsmiths in Jerusalem had monopolised the supply of a coin called the half shekel of the sanctuary, which worshippers needed to pay taxes in the temple. So they had to do sacrifices, but for those sacrifices they needed to use this coin. But the money changers had monopolised supply of it, so they were racking up the price of this little coin. And that's one of the reasons that Jesus got so annoyed, is because they're basically using what's going on in the temple to monopolise the supply of something and to make profits, unwarranted profits. And of course, this is a similar situation we're in today with things like gas, electricity, the railways, is that where you've got these private monopolies or cartels who are actually jacking up the price of all these products because the government regulation is so incredibly weak now. So when the Romans invaded, there was a lot of resistance in Britain by the Iceni in East Anglia, who were a tribe, and also the Ordovice in North Wales. These were very agile tribes. They didn't have any specific capital or base, so they were able to harry the Romans for many, many years after the invasion. But Roman tributes, the money system, started to begin to come in. We go up to near 1,000 years or so, then we come to the time of the Doomsday Book. That was just after the Norman invasion. Now, the Doomsday Book was called Doomsday by the people who lived in those days because it had connotations to do with the end of the world. This is what a lot of the local people in Britain were called it, nicknamed it Doomsday, because there's no appeal. Once something was written down as a tax in the Doomsday Book, you had to pay it. There was no question. Even if you had a bad harvest, etc., you had to pay your tax. And this was seen as very unfair because there was no right of appeal. This is why people nicknamed it Doomsday. And there were riots across Britain as these commissioners went around collecting all the information for the Doomsday Book. Go on a little bit to 1070 and 1071, and the results of Doomsday really were horrific. There was a resistance to the Norman invasion by people like Hereward the Wake, based in Ely, because I think, you know, often we accept the Norman invasion as just simply it happened, but there were people who were extremely angry about it and saw it as a sort of infiltration and takeover of the country. Hereward caused all sorts of problems for the Romans. They had to send loads of for the Normans. They had to send loads of soldiers to fight him, and eventually he just melted away into the fens in East Anglia after causing them so much hassle. And I think it's been fair to say that there's been a tradition of resistance against this kind of Roman-Norman elitist establishment ever since these times. In 1118, it was an important day. It was the date that the Knights Templar were founded, and this was formed by Hugo de Payens. It was the first multinational bank. Now, the Knights Templar were thought of as a sort of chivalric order of honourable knights, but they weren't actually. They were a private armed army, and they're still around today in the form of orders of Freemasonry. They started in Britain, in Strand, just near the Strand, somewhere called the Temple in London. Bristol here, we are quite famous for having Temple Meads, which was where the Knights Templar were based here in Bristol. And they had bases in other countries in Europe and, of course, in Jerusalem. And the reason that they are thought of as the first multinational corporation is you could pay your money in Bristol, and you could trot out to the Holy Land and you could withdraw it from the Templar Bank in Jerusalem. So they were able to cross all sorts of borders. The other thing was they were trusted, or at least they were one of the bunches of people that were trusted, by lots of kings and queens to look after all their wealth, their gold, and this kind of thing, right across Europe. So they had a network of power, and they were very, because of course they were looking after all the riches of the kings and queens, they were very trusted by those kings and queens, and so they could do all sorts of stuff right across borders, and they had certain forms of immunity. There is an expression as well called drunk as a Templar, which people used to use in medieval times because they were seen to be in some way above the law, a little bit like some people seem to be today, you know, with impunity in Pinochet in South America and places like that. So on we go to, and this is of course to do with money and the control of money. There was something else going on in England, and this is one of the reasons why we had the Industrial Revolution here, was because of enclosure. Enclosure is the privatisation of land. What land which was shared amongst people in a village, it was enclosed. And the first one of those enclosures, or privatisations, was in 1235. That's the Statute of Merton, in just out near Surrey somewhere, and done by Henry III. So this is actually a momentous occasion where Parliament decided and the King decided that it was okay to take land which was used by all the commoners, everybody in a village, and actually make it the property of one specific individual after that. Now, land is a funny thing, isn't it? Because, I mean, we can have property, like we can have books, you know, that's a piece of property, but is the land under our feet the same kind of thing? Well, I would argue no, it isn't. What is your property is something that you have made, owned or bought, but the idea that you can own something which is the land under your feet seems very strange, particularly if it's a corporation that owns it. I mean, what's happening the way that corporate greed is going nowadays in banking is that we're going to end up with one giant corporation owning all the land under our feet and no private individuals owning hardly anything. In fact, we're in a situation now where most people actually don't own any land at all, even though we all need it to live on. Some people, even who think they do own the land, this is people with mortgages and property, actually they don't. The bank owns the land. They are just an agent of the banks managing the land, and they're repaying a loan. But say, for example, they lose their income, as many people are doing in the recession. Suddenly, they realise they never owned that land in the first place, because the deeds are in the possession of the bank, and they never did actually own the land. They were just a sort of part-time tenant on it, who was subletting it to the people who were using it. So you have a very strange psychology with land. A lot of people that say, "Oh, I own my own home," don't actually own their own home, even though they like to think they do. And this, of course, is part of the sales tactics of the mortgage companies to get you to take out a mortgage, is because you think you own your own home. Actually, you don't. And this is partly because the word mortgage is a French word, which means the grip of death. it's a kind of trick, a mortgage and money lending. And of course, back in the old days when church law was still around, and under many other types of law like Sharia law and in Jewish law, for example, interest is illegal. So you're not allowed to charge interest, and you wouldn't be allowed to have a mortgage if we were back in medieval times. So that was the first privatisation of land, the Statute of Merton in 1235. Let's roll on another few years to 1312, and this is when the Templars, the Knights Templar I mentioned before, were dissolved by Philip the Fair of France. The Grand Master was Jack de Molay of the Knights Templar, and he was executed. And there were all sorts of reasons why, because the Knights Templar had become much too powerful back in 1312. This was a very big, bad thing for the Templars, because they were then on the run right across Europe. And many people believe they went to Spain and then came, and some of the leaders of the Templars settled in Scotland in a place called Roslyn Chapel after that. But many of us obviously escaped, but many were also burnt at the stake, because the order was found actually to be an occult order, not a Christian order at all, where part of the initiation was doing things like spitting on the cross and various other disgusting anti-Christian acts. And that was the reason why Philip the Fair of France decided to extinguish the Templars and get them all arrested. And the French paid the price later on in history, which I'll tell you about later. So, 1312, the Templars were dissolved, and many were executed for their criminal behaviour behind the guise of this holy Christian order, which of course they weren't. Now, after that, something quite interesting happened here in Britain. In 1348, the Order of the Garter was formed. Now, this was around the time of Edward III, and there were all sorts of myths about how this happened, to do with the garter being round a lady's leg and it falling off. But actually, of course, the garter is a symbol, as some people may know, in witchcraft. It's very clear to me that this was just simply another order, rather similar to the Templars that created. In fact, there are 26 knights of the garter, which equals two covens, two witches' covens. So it does look as if, ever since the time of Edward III, this Order of the Garter, which is based in Windsor Castle, has been very much associated with the control of the British Crown ever since that time by another, a different order, but along similar lines to the Templars. They're not there to protect the Crown. They are there to control the Crown. And there are many people, if you can have a look at the list of today of people who are members of the Order of the Garter, they're all sort of dodgy, suspicious characters. I don't think that there's any one single person who you could say is incredibly honourable and chivalrous and deserves that kind of role. So it's very difficult, I think, for the royal family to really be their own people with these 26 members of the Order of the Garter constantly following them around and so-called protecting them. It's a kind of, you know, sort of protection you might get from gangsters rather than from some honourable knights, like, you know, something like the Myth of the Round Table or whatever. Okay, so later on in the 1300s, we had the Peasants' Revolt. The situation in Britain was getting worse and worse, really heavy taxes. And down in Kent, Wat Tyler and some of his friends got organised with a massive resistance, and they took over large parts of London and demanded various things from the king, which where they were promised that there would be more kindness given to the peasants. But then, of course, the king reneged on his promise and had Wat Tyler arrested and murdered. I would say murdered, because I don't think it's justice. He was representing literally thousands and thousands of peasants and trying to negotiate with the king, and of course the king, because he was powerful, reneged on the deal. Okay, so that was 1381. Go forwards a few more years to Martin Luther in Germany. That's 1520. This is where the Protestant Reformation started, and this is really strange, because the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, both of them are flawed. Of course, anything earthly is bound to be flawed. We've got problems with the Pope, but the problem with the Protestant Church under Martin Luther is that they seem to be rather more anxious to admit occultists to the church than the Catholics had been. So whilst we get, you know, the one bad thing with the Catholics, we've got other bad things with the Protestants. That was 1520. Then 1535, we had a massive changes here in Britain, the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII. That was 1535 to 40. Now this meant a massive change in the country, because it meant that no longer were the monasteries going to be independent. They were all taken over and controlled by the king. This affected 900 different monastic communities across the country, which was the equivalent of about 9,000 monks and nuns. And of course, the big bonus for the king was this brought in £90,000 per year extra for the king. That was the real, I think, the real reason for the Reformation, is because it meant that the king was now, in Britain anyway, was running things, not the Catholic Church. So we move on a bit later in that century, and 1549, there was something called Kett's Rebellion in Norfolk. East Anglia was ruled from under an oak tree by a landowner called Robert Kett. Kett had been a very good friend of the peasants around that area, and he'd always been complaining when land was enclosed. We're going back to talk about land enclosure, privatisation again. What happened when the land was enclosed was it was privatised, it was given to a big landowner, and whereas they had open fields before, fences and ditches went up, and there were all sorts of problems because the peasants no longer had land they could cultivate. Often it was turned over to sheep and livestock, rather than people being able to grow their own food, being able to grow crops. So the rebellion lasts for about a month and a half, involved many thousands of the local peasants, and actually they actually decided, oh well, look, Robert Kett can actually run East Anglia from under an oak tree, and he did. The landowners who'd been enclosing, privatising their land up until the rebellion, many of them were arrested, and they were quite properly tried, questioned, and some of them were imprisoned for stealing the land. Basically, the peasants were saying, well, look, you know, this is the very basic stuff that we need to live on, and if you're going to take it, privatise it, that's theft. Anyway, after about 6 weeks, 2 months, and several attempts by the Crown to take over Norfolk, to get rid of Robert Kett, they were then beaten back by the peasants with their pitchforks. After about 6 weeks, finally an army from all over the country was mustered by the king and sent to put down the rebellion. And eventually Robert Kett, for his trouble, trying to keep the land for the people, was strung up by chains from the walls of Norwich. And all the landowners that had been stealing the land were then let out by the king and allowed to carry on their dirty work. And the ditches that had been filled in by the peasants, what happened, the fences went up, the ditches went in, those were all returned by the peasants as part of the revolt. They flattened the land so that the land was open again, and all the fences started going up again after the rebellion, the Kett's Rebellion in 1649 with Robert Kett. And Kett's Oak, I believe, near Wyndham is still there, actually just south of Norwich. So we move on now to the English Civil War. Now, the English Civil War in the 1600s started in 1642, ended in 1649, but the problems that led to it began in the 1630s. Again, this was King Charles I doing something to try and stop enclosure. Enclosure was seen as something very bad in those days by many people, who could see that it was taking away a whole peasant class. Meaning that these peasants, people who had been landowners, had been able to grow their own food, have somewhere to live, were actually being taken off the land and being sold into employment. So they had to work for a big landowner in order to get some money to buy some food. At no point was any of the food that they were growing, the livestock they were working on, no point was it theirs. They didn't have direct access. They had to go through a lord of the manor of some sort. So King Charles I actually started fining landowners who were privatising land, started fining the enclosing landowners, quite big fines, and saying to them, well look, you know, if you don't want to pay the fine, just let the peasants back onto the land. And this was happening in the 1630s. There's many references for this, some of which I've put up on the internet, but it's quite an obscure fact. Many people don't realise that this was going on before the English Civil War. So war actually broke out in 1642 between the feudal classes. I mean, some people call it a revolution, of course it wasn't. It was a civil war between the two main classes at the time, which was the merchant classes, which you would encapsulate with the City of London, and the feudal classes, the old feudal barons, the dukes, and the lords of the manor across the country were very much divided. Some of them supported the moneyed classes and the enclosers of the land, and others supported the king, people who thought that actually the peasants should be able to keep their land, and wanted the status quo, a kind of conservative force versus a very radical, let's get everybody off the land, then they can come and work for us. And so ultimately, through the Civil War, the merchants won. And after the English Civil War, there was a rapid acceleration in enclosure. But one thing that did happen during that time was there were a lot of radical thinkers, a lot of radical thinking going on during the English Civil War. In 1645, which was in the middle of the war, the Levellers emerged. They were against the distinctions of class and wealth. They were led by Lieutenant General in Cromwell's army, John Lilburn, who's also known as Freeborn John, Richard Overton and William Walwyn, who were pamphleteers and writers, saying, well, hang on a minute, if we're going to have a civil war, we want something better at the end of it. We don't want something worse. And they could see it was going that way, towards complete control of the country by the merchant classes, by the moneyed people, and that the ordinary people were not going to get much of a say. There was also the diggers in 1649 under Gerard Winstanley, who said, the earth is a common treasury for all. Now, Winstanley was going back in a way to Leviticus, saying, look, the earth everybody needs, the land everybody needs, so let's just use this opportunity to share it out. We've not got a king anymore, and the king was the landowner of all of Britain, so now let's just share out the land. But of course that didn't happen. The merchant classes closed in on Winstanley and his diggers, who'd taken a bit of common land in St George's Hill in Surrey, which is now a private gated estate. It's like the Beverly Hills of Britain, incidentally, which is ironic since that was where the freedom of the land movement in the Civil War started. And so Winstanley eventually ended up as a Quaker, but his protests and his pamphlets have gone right down the years. In fact, you can see much of the history of the Civil War is all about this struggle over land and about equality in the country. Actually, it ended up Cromwell and the parliamentarians winning and ignoring all of the calls of the soldiers, and the ordinary people who'd fought for him were ignored. And there is a lot of literature about this. After the Second World War, Christopher Hill wrote a book called The World Turned Upside Down. There's a book by Brailsford, which is called The Levellers and the English Revolution, which talks about this. There's very, very little known and taught in history about all this period. But Brailsford's book particularly goes into all of the very nitty-gritty detail of what struggles were going on within the army, what this English Civil War was really all about. And there's also a film called Winstanley, made by Kevin Brownlow in the 1970s. It was a very interesting film because it was made in black and white, and it was made with all volunteer labour making the film, and many volunteer actors apart from one or two professional actors in the lead role. So that's well worth watching if you want to understand what the English Civil War was really all about. And of course it was a very important war historically, because it was the first time that an entire country was controlled by the merchant classes. Now, up until then, you'd had city-states, which were very much ruled, like places like Venice and Bristol, who were, you know, not necessarily entirely controlled, but run to a large extent by the merchants. When Cromwell and his faction took over Britain, that was the first time that the merchant classes, in other words, not a king, not a feudal system, had been running the country. And that's one of the reasons why enclosure rapidly increased, because this was very lucrative for the merchants. If they could kick everybody off the land, they had loads of cheap labour, and also they had that land to do what they wanted with. And the reason they managed to do this was because only landowners could vote in Parliament. So basically the peasants were totally disenfranchised and cheated by the English Civil War. So the diggers and the levellers were probably the two most important movements in the Civil War. The other thing is, of course, that This led to mass urbanisation afterwards, Britain and the Industrial Revolution. The fact that we managed, through the Civil War, to kick all the peasants off the land through enclosure meant that you had loads and loads and loads of labourers desperate to work. So yeah, and you also had a division of wealth. You had the factory merchant classes who could build factories. They had plenty of money to do almost anything they wanted with, and then plenty of very, very cheap labour, these poor peasants who were desperate for a little bit of money to survive, to work for them. So the English Civil War was very, very important, and of course it was one of the reasons why we had the agricultural revolution and industrial revolution here in Britain, and why that led to the biggest empire the world's ever seen, where we went round taking over bits of the world here, there and everywhere, and became the bullies of the world for a while. This whole prominence of Britain was due to what happened during the English Civil War and the power that the merchants got from the English Civil War. Despite a lot of people saying it was a battle over religious ideas, it wasn't at all. It was just a simple power battle. Now, after that was the private banking system that started after the English Civil War, and we'll talk about that in a minute.